In this episode, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals hears Patterson versus Six Flags Theme Parks. The case arises from an Americans with Disabilities Act lawsuit brought by a deaf patron of a Six Flags amusement park. After a bench trial, the district court entered a permanent injunction requiring Six Flags to provide sign language interpreters and other accommodations. The narrow legal issue on appeal concerns the district court's oversight and monitoring provisions. Specifically, whether the judge abused her discretion by imposing a 3-year external auditing and monitoring period, during which the plaintiff and his counsel may review Six Flags compliance records with 30 days' notice. Six Flags argues that the 3-year term lacks support in the factual record and that no legal standard authorizes such intrusive ongoing oversight. The appellee, Mr. Patterson, responds that the district court made meticulous factual findings of systemic failures and that the monitoring provisions are reasonable given Six Flags' long-standing lack of attention to its ADA obligations, even decades after the statute took effect.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Sanaz Charzai on behalf of Appellant Six Flags Theme Parks, Inc., Six Flags Entertainment Corporation, and Park Management Corp. On appeal this morning, Appellant appeals a very narrow issue as to the scope of the District Court's order related to oversight, monitoring, and external auditing of Appellant's ADA compliance after the permanent injunction was issued on February 28, 2025. The narrow issue before this honorable court is whether the order permitting continued monitoring, external auditing, and court oversight of ADA compliance by both the district court and individually by Mr. Patterson as to the external auditing for a 3-year period was an error.
Let me ask you this. Our standard of review is abuse of discretion, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, as to the issues related to the factual determination.
Abuse of discretion is the standard of review that appellate courts apply when examining many decisions by a trial judge, including the terms of an injunction. Under this deferential standard, an appellate court will reverse only if the district court made a clear error of judgment, applied the wrong legal rule, or relied on clearly erroneous factual findings. The reviewing court does not simply substitute its own view. It asks whether the judge's decision fell outside the range of permissible choices, given the facts and the law.
Determinations in the record.
Aren't we reviewing what the district court judge did?
We are reviewing what the district court judge did, and in this case, that's important here because there's no evidence at all in the record or analysis in the record as to why the 3-year specific external auditing and mandatory.
Did you object to the district court? Did you say, Judge, 3 years is just too long because it's, you know, it's burdensome, it's a hassle, it's it's unnecessary. Did you bring any of those issues to the attention of the district judge?
Yes, Your Honor. My response to that would be twofold. One, the district court's procedure that was mandated was that each party submit its own proposed order. In our proposed order, as a compromise provision, what occurred is when we asked for a 1-year, if the court was going to implement external auditing or monitoring, that it would be for a 1-year period. The court overruled that by...
In federal litigation, after a court decides liability or the need for an injunction, it often directs the parties to submit competing proposed orders setting out the specific relief each side believes is appropriate. The judge then reviews both proposals and crafts a final order, sometimes adopting one side's language, sometimes blending or modifying the submissions. To preserve an issue for appeal, a party typically must make a clear, specific objection once the court has ruled, not merely submit an alternative draft. The question in this case is whether redlining a 3-year term down to 1 year, without further objection after the court chose 3, was enough to alert the judge and preserve the issue.
Implementing a 3-year period without any discussion or legal authority.
Did you offer any? The other side offered 3 years, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And did you? And I thought the judge asked for, you know, sort of objections or whatever.
The judge asked for objections as well as a proposed injunction.
So when they submitted their order, did you object to these provisions?
The objection was within the proposed we maintain the objections within the proposed injunction offered by the appellants in the court below.
So let me follow up on Judge Pius's question. I see, for example, on ER 81, which is what you submitted, that you did redline the proposal from 3 years to 1 year.
Correct,
so you suggested 1 year. But I don't see anywhere, and refer me to someplace in the record if I'm wrong, but I don't see anywhere where you objected to the audit provision. As far as I can tell, that's also on ER 81. You didn't redline the audit provision. So where did you object to the district court to that provision?
That provision wasn't specifically objected to in the record. However, there was an overall objection as to preserving the waiver of appellate rights.
I'm personally not concerned that you waive this. The judge said you need to meet and confer. You were trying to meet and confer. You were doing what the judge said. The judge said you got to preserve all your appellate issues. But waiver is a different question to me than whether you said you, I'll make up a number here, I'll just invent a number. You objected to 10 provisions, I'm just making that number up, in the proposed PI, and this is one you didn't redline. So how did the judge even know that on the audit provision you had a problem with it? Yeah, you preserved your right to object to everything, but on this one where the judge said, meet and confer, tell me where you have a problem, some the judge went with you, some the judge went with your friend, but how would the judge even know you didn't like this provision?
Well, I think the audit provision encompasses the period of time provision. So if the audit provision, although there's not a specific red line to the audit provision, it follows that any external auditing, external oversight would be limited to that 1 year period. And when the court rejected the 1 year period and adopted a 3-year period without legal analysis, then that made it ripe for review on appeal. As to,
well, I understand your argument as why the audit provision should be, based on your objection, should be 1 year as opposed to 3 years, but you've said in your brief that the audit provision should just get thrown out entirely, right?
Well, I think the audit provision, there's not a legal standard that allows for the audit provision. And so for that reason, because there's no legal standard that allows for the audit provision and there's no factual record that developed the audit provision.
Didn't the district court have discretion to include it, though, based on her findings and factors and conclusions of law?
I agree that there's a abuse of discretion in the district court can include it.
Sure.
However, it needs to be based on the record and an analysis of a factual record that's developed. And in this case, the audit provision that was offered by Mr. Patterson was added after the fact, after the November 2024 order that invited a proposed injunction for internal auditing.
Internal auditing refers to a company's own review of its compliance with legal requirements, generating reports for its own use or for submission to a court. External auditing, by contrast, allows an outside party, such as opposing counsel or an independent expert, to inspect the company's records and verify compliance. In this case, the district court's initial order contemplated internal auditing by Six Flags. The plaintiff then proposed adding an external audit provision, allowing Mr. Patterson's lawyers to review the compliance records directly. Six Flags contends that this external oversight was never invited by the court and lacks a factual or legal foundation in the record.
The court never invited an external auditing provision. That was after the fact, after the record was developed in the trial.
It looks to me like the district court did a careful review of the proposed injunction from the plaintiffs and your proposed injunction. She had she had written careful findings of fact and conclusions of law, and you can tell that by reading her order. And she was very familiar with the case, no question about that. And when you read what happened here to the petitioner, and her one of her first observations was that the ADA has been in effect for many years, but it seems to Six Flags hasn't quite seemed to caught on yet after all these years. You know, maybe she just thought in her discretion that this was the best way to sort of get Six Flags into line, at least with respect to the petitioner here. She clearly adopted your view that any order had to be limited to this particular location and not Magic Mountain in Southern California or elsewhere.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, she had lots of discretion here, and there was quite an interesting record here.
I agree with you that the court exercises discretion as to certain aspects of the objections on both sides and as to the proposed injunction on both sides. We are not disputing that underlying injunction or the grounds for the underlying injunction. The narrow issue is whether or not there is supporting legal authority or a factual record, which I don't believe was...
says that what she did was unlawful.
Well, I don't think we need to determine whether it was unlawful. I think the issue...
She just said that there's an absence of legal authority for what she did.
There's an absence of legal authority for the court to impose an auditing requirement for a three-year specific period without any analysis or support the record.
But counsel, you know, it certainly is the law, as I understand it, that if the district court has made a clear error of law, that is a per se abuse of discretion.
Even under the deferential abuse of discretion standard, an appellate court will find a per se abuse of discretion if the trial judge committed a clear error of law. In other words, discretion must be exercised within the boundaries of applicable legal rules. If a judge applies the wrong legal test or acts without any legal authority for a particular remedy, that can constitute reversible error regardless of how reasonable the decision might seem on the facts. Six Flags argues that no legal standard authorizes the three-year external audit provision the district court imposed.
Apply something like that standard in many contexts. But as I look at the record here, there was an entity which knew about the ADA, but in certain circumstances, including involving the plaintiff, paid very little attention to it over a significant period of time. And it from my look at the record, it didn't look like this was some sort of strike suit plaintiff. It was a plaintiff who was trying to enjoy amusement parks. And there was a lot of facts here. And the district court said, I think we need 3 years. And I think it'll keep your eye on the ball that if a third party like the plaintiff's lawyers can come in and look at stuff, it's more likely that you're going to do what you need to do. So I don't think there are any magic words the district court needs. So what is it about this, for example, that is so overly burdensome that the district court doing this is a clear abuse of discretion?
The burden arises from the court having to be involved with the ADA compliance for a three-year period of time. And beyond that, their order allows upon any request by the plaintiff, and now appellee's counsel, to ask to audit these records upon 30 days notice for an unlimited period of time. At this point, we are now 1 year past.
Although what the order says is what they can review, unless I'm misreading it, are only the records that are required to be maintained by the PI order, right? It's not like they can go in and give you a list of 50 things that aren't required to be maintained. It's they get to audit what the order requires you to maintain. Am I misreading this?
No, Your Honor. I agree that it's what the order requires to maintain, but at this, the same time, appellate is still under the oversight of the court, even though it has submitted these quarterly compliance reports and will continue to be over the oversight of the court for another 2 years. Whenever a plaintiff has a request without any limitations other than 30 days to comply.
Is there anything that would stop you from, say, after 18 months or after 20 months coming back to the court and saying, look at all of this good stuff we've done. Look at how much we are in compliance. Look at how much we're complying with the ADA. Look at the fact that plaintiff and their lawyer have no complaints at all or almost no complaints about what we've done. Why don't you reduce the number from 3 to 2? Is there anything that stops you from doing that?
The order itself, I think, would stop us from doing it because the court has indicated that we would need to show a significant cause or good cause in order for a modification. And then the same arguments that were presented with today in this appeal would arise if we try to modify it later.
Counsel, let me come at this from a slightly different perspective, and that is, how is this different from parties in a trial preparing competing jury instruction proposals, and the court then chooses one or the other or modifies the court's standard instructions?
The panel draws an analogy to jury instructions. In both criminal and civil trials, lawyers submit proposed instructions to the judge, who then chooses which to give. Federal rules require counsel to make a specific, on-the-record objection to an instruction after the court has stated which instructions it will use. Simply submitting a competing proposal is not enough to preserve the issue for appeal. The judges here ask whether the same principle applies to proposed injunction language. Must a party object again after the court issues its order, or is the initial red line submission sufficient?
Don't we require counsel to make a specific objection on the record once the court chooses which way it's going to go? As I understand your argument, it's simply, well, we redlined it, and that's good enough. And I'm not sure that gets you there if my analogy to proposing jury instructions holds.
I understand your analogy, Your Honor, and jury instructions, and when both sides submit proposed orders or proposed jury instructions or proposed verdict form, and they present that to the court, that's can be enough to preserve it on appeal. But in this case,
well, we require a specific objection to be made, or you have waived your objection to that particular formulation of the instruction. And I think it's directly analogous to the situation here. You had to do more than simply submit a competing proposal.
We submitted a competing proposal with a reduced scope as to the time period. So I think if we
But you didn't once the court chose 3 years, you didn't specifically say, Your Honor, we object to the 3-year period, and I'm preserving that objection for appeal.
No, I agree with you. There's not a specific line or specific form in which that objection was provided for the 3-year period. It was included in the proposed injunction order, and the court also allowed us to preserve all of our rights on appeal and included that specifically
but
in
that
the injunction
necessary.
Itself.
I mean, I'll take Judge Bennett's question with regard to the audit provision itself. You didn't redline that. And
correct.
So how would the court know that that was even at issue without counsel specifically directing the court's attention that we object to the audit provision?
Well, the audit provision would be under the 1 year period of time.
No, I'm saying after the court essentially said, I'm going to go with 3, I think it's incumbent upon you to say, well, we object to the 3-year period.
Well, I that would have required additional post-order briefing, or which wasn't invited by the court at that point.
Counsel, let me.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
So I should know the answer to this, and I apologize for not knowing the answer. But you submitted your red lines. Was the first time you learned as to which the court was accepting and which it wasn't was when the court issued the PI itself? Or did the court say, here's my proposed PI, do you have any further objections?
I don't believe it was the latter. I believe it was the former, that each party submitted their proposed injunctions and then the court issued its order.
So the first time you learned that the court had rejected some of your proposed changes was when the court issued the PI.
That's my recollection of the record and the proceedings.
Okay, well, your friend can tell us, too. So if that were the case, the only method you would have had for objecting was essentially moving for recon.
Correct. Or additional modification or appellate action.
All right. We've taken up a lot of your time. We'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
A motion for reconsideration asks the trial court to revisit and change a decision it has already made, typically based on a claim that the court overlooked controlling law or clear facts. If a party learns of an adverse ruling only when the final order is entered and had no prior opportunity to object, a motion for reconsideration or a motion to modify the order may be the only procedural route to preserve an objection. In this case, Six Flags suggests that because the district court issued its permanent injunction without inviting further briefing, the first opportunity to object formally would have been through such a post-order motion.
May it please the court, Andrew Rosinski for the appellee, Mr. Patterson. The court raised a lot of the questions and issues that I've raised in the brief and asked very great questions, and I don't want to be repetitive regarding things that were already discussed. But to put a finer point on things, the court is correct in saying that the monitoring provisions that are largely at issue at this appeal were not redlined or specifically objected to. There were two very specific objections that the appellant did make on the record, and that was to the nationwide injunction and to the VR to the use of video remote interpreting. And those were the two specific objections.
You don't consider a red line an objection?
I do not consider a red line a objection.
The judge adopted what I would view as a practical approach to this, where the judge said, you know, we have a winner. We're going to have a PI, and I want you guys to see if you can agree on a compromise, but she wrote, nobody's waiving anything, because she wanted people to try to see if they could agree, even though there was a winner and a loser, right?
Right.
So why wouldn't, this doesn't go to whether three as opposed to one is an abuse of discretion, but why wouldn't redlining three and putting in one, why wouldn't that be sufficient to alert the district court to, we don't think three is the right number?
Well, I think it could, and I think the jury instruction example is a very good example.
Well, one difference is that there is a specific rule of criminal procedure which requires certain actions in order to preserve for appeal an objection to a jury instruction. I can't remember if they have the same rule in the rules of civil procedure, but in criminal procedure, you don't do A, B, and C. You can't come to us unless it's plain error.
Yes, Your Honor. I think in this context, I think that it could, even arguing that it was an objection, I think that the court gave very careful thinking and gave meticulous factual findings as to why she believed, based on this record, that the monitoring period was warranted in her decision.
Yeah, why don't you tell me about that? And three seems kind of long to me for a case like this. The fact that it seems kind of long to me doesn't mean that even if my colleagues agreed it was kind of long, that it was an abuse of discretion. But why in a case like this do you need three when there are procedures that have to be in place, there have to be changes that are made if they're not complying after one or two. If that were the number, you could ask the judge to extend it. How have things been going?
Well, they haven't provided us access to the underlying records. We're only seeing what they're filing on the docket.
Have you asked?
I have asked, and they've said that pending appeal, they are refusing to provide those records.
Okay, so you're talking about the audit provision?
Correct.
So you have made, under the PI, a request for the records that the district court ordered them to provide you, and they've said we're not going to give you those pending appeal?
Correct, Your Honor.
I thought they said they didn't have any because in the time period that had passed, they hadn't had any requests for accommodation.
There have been quarterly reports where there have been requests for accommodations that have been submitted to the district judge through these quarterly reports. So there would be records that...
Oh, some periods, yes, some periods, no.
Correct,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
But you've made requests and you haven't gotten anything.
Correct. We made a request and we were told that they will not be giving us any records until this appeal is resolved.
And I assume your strategic decision is you're going to wait to do anything about it till you see what we do.
Correct, Your Honor. And going back to your original, the findings that of systemic failure is because these requests, just from the monitoring periods, they come and go. You're not going to get a request every day for a sign language interpreter at these parks. They're going to come maybe once every 4 months or 6 months or, you know,
but
8 months.
We're not talking about a huge amount of work here in order to respond to your request.
Correct. Over the 3-year period, there might be only 10 requests, right. Over the 3-year period. So this is not a onerous, in our view, burden for them to do this. So if the court wants the factual findings that we believe support this, one thing that was mentioned that after, the quote about after all these years, they don't seem to understand their obligations. Even at trial, they were pushing back regarding, their duties and obligations in doing this. One of the things that was striking is at trial when I asked, when did you, do some research on providing an interpreter, for deaf people, and their corporate witness said last night. At trial was the first time that they had looked at into, whether interpreters can be provided, and they could have vendors that could provide those services. And so the court here did very careful findings, and I can point the court to, ER 23, 1 ER 24, 1 ER 26. Those are records to kind of that show the factual findings that the court had made to support her findings, and I think they're reasonable under these circumstances. Over a 1-year period, we might have only had one or two requests, and that might not be enough to determine. Okay, they know their obligations, they know what to do. They're good, and we can send them off, and they'll be fine moving forward. So. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll...
No, I don't.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Why don't you wait a minute before starting the clock? I'm going to ask this question. Here, come on up. This question, not going to use your 2 minutes for it. Is what counsel said right, that he has made requests? Your response to him is that notwithstanding that there's no stay in effect and notwithstanding that this is a PI order, you're not going to do anything in response to his requests until we rule? Is that accurate?
No, Your Honor, that is inaccurate. My firm has not received any request for review of the records or implementation of the auditing provisions.
That was... my recollection of what we had been told in the briefing, but I was unclear about whether my recollection about what we had been told was correct or not. So thank you. And go ahead.
And I want to
resolve this. He says he did. You say he didn't.
Correct, Your Honor. And I want to.
You want to take an oath here and step
well,
up?
Well, I could represent that we didn't, but I think that is when I was thinking about this at council desk, why we need a remand for the court to fully develop the record here. We have now a
one-year. We can start the clock now.
Thank you, Your Honor. We now have a one-year compliance period. The district court has adequate information with a developed record post the permanent injunction order to see if we are in compliance. There has not been any auditing request, but if counsel believes that there is something that we should have looked at, we didn't receive it, whatever it may be. That's for the district court to look at upon remand to see if that 1 year that we have now elapsed and participated in was sufficient to meet the goals of the permanent injunction.
I presume, counsel, that your client and you are not going to take a position that they don't have to comply with the PI order until we rule if there's no stay, right?
I agree. We haven't asked for a stay. No, I've actually been waiting for an audit trigger, so I've been cognizant that that might come in, and we haven't received one. And there's certainly never been anything developed in the district court record that we're not in compliance. So I think that now that we have a one-year compliance period, the court, the district court can look at the record to see if we need a three-year compliance period to meet the goals of ADA compliance. And I think that that record wasn't developed the first time around, but on remand, that's the very specific issue, is whether that one-year compliance that's already occurred would be sufficient to meet the goals of ADA compliance.
You keep saying 1 year, but the order says three.
The order says three, which
and
we believe.
And that clock started when the district court issued the preliminary injunction. But,
yes.
I just have one minor question for you.
Correct.
The district court called for Patterson to file proposed injunction first, correct?
Yes. Well, I believe it was simultaneously.
That's what I was going to ask you. Where is it? Were you called? Where did the district court order simultaneous proposals, or did the district court order plaintiff to file
plaintiff,
and then you file a response?
I believe that plaintiff submitted it to us first, informally, and I would have to clarify that, but my recollection is that plaintiff submitted us formally, and then we filed our objections and a response simultaneously. So the meet and confer occurred outside of the district court filings before the actual filing occurred, and then there was a simultaneous.
And there was never any discussion about the three-year term?
There was a discussion as a compromise of making a one-year term, which counsel did not agree to.
And in your response, you didn't really discuss that, did you?
We didn't have a separate filing as to the objections, but there wasn't a separate filing.
But there's something in your department titled Defendant Status Report and Response to Meet and Confer Results, Ray Proposed Injunction.
Correct. And that was the proposed injunction that we offered to the court with the 1 year.
And that's where you redlined it on ER 81.
Yes,
suggesting
I believe so.
But you knew he was he was planning to request 3 years.
He had already submitted a 3 year as well. Yes. So that's why we redlined it to 1 year.
My point is that I didn't see anything in this document that I just identified that says, you know, we don't need a 3 year.
There wasn't a full discussion on that 3 year, but there was the 1 year provision that was redlined. And I agree with Your Honor that we didn't have a separate objection form or anything related to a separate briefing on the 3 year. It was within the red line of 1 year.
Counsel, has this case been reassigned to a new district judge? Because Judge Mueller has retired, has she not? She was the judge who conducted the bench trial.
Yes, I actually don't believe that we've received the notice of a reassignment.
So if this goes back, it's not going to be heard by her.
That's interesting, Your Honor. Yeah, I don't believe that we received a notice of reassignment.
And that's a problem because she was the one who heard the testimony at the trial since it was a bench trial.
We would have to resubmit certain evidence as to this narrowed issue to develop a record.
which is happens if the
counsel, even if there's no remand, I mean it's up to you what to do, but I don't see anything in this order which would prevent you from asking a newly assigned judge, even if we just simply affirm the PI order, to say things have changed. We think you should relook at it and reduce the number to 2 years. I don't see anything in the PI order that prevents you from doing that, is there?
I believe that we might have a procedural issue of doing that if that's not included in any opinion.
Is there a final judgment in the case?
Judge Mueller did enter a final judgment in the case.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So if there's a final judgment, then there would be a problem. I apologize.
So I think that's why the appeal was very important for us to.
No, you're right about that. If there's a final judgment, but I still think even with a final judgment, you still could go in and seek a modification based on changed circumstances, but of the injunction
as to,
because the judgment allows the injunction to be entered. The judgment covered other matters as well.
Correct.
Damages.
And those have been satisfied.
Right.
Right. So we satisfied
and
damages.
He authorized the issuance of an injunction, which was what we're dealing with here. And I think the rule of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 65 always allows the parties to go back and ask for modifications of the injunction.
I suspect we've all seen cases where it comes 20 years later.
Yeah.
And I think that could be a procedure, but I do see some hiccups in it, that if there's an appeal, depending on how the appellate order is brought down, whether that would be any preclusion in arguing a potential modification as to the time period.
All right. Well, we thank counsel for their arguments. The case just argued is submitted, and with that, we are adjourned for the day.
The argument you have just heard does not indicate how the Court of Appeals will rule. The Ninth Circuit panel will issue a written opinion in due course. Because this is a decision on a permanent injunction following a bench trial, the court's ruling will determine whether the 3-year monitoring and external audit provisions stand as ordered, are reduced in scope, or are vacated and remanded for further factual development. No timeline for the decision was announced at oral argument.